Platforms, Architecture and the Use of the Ground by Dogma in 2021. In 1962, Jorn Utzon, the architect of the Sydney Opera House, published a short yet seminal essay titled Platforms and Plateaus. The text is an account of his fascination with the new architecture of the platform, of which Utzon mentions a few examples, including the massive platforms in the Yucatan, the plinth upon which Old Delhi's Jama Masjid sits, the floor of the traditional Japanese house, and the mysterious architecture of Monte Alban in Mexico. By highlighting the platform, Utzon put forward an idea of an architecture that defines space without enclosing it. Yet it is precisely the subtleness of the platform as a space that manipulates the most essential datum of existence, the ground, that makes this type of architecture an ambivalent form that both enables and restricts what happens upon it. Utzon's interest in the platform can be developed further toward a more critical genealogy of this architectural form. Platforms are not just pedestals that function to single something out of their immediate contexts. They are alterations of the ground that can be read as tangible indexes of power relationships. It is not by chance that since the 19th century, the term has been used outside of architecture, first within parliamentary politics to refer to party policies and institutions, and more recently in the digital world, in order to address giant internet corporations that mediate interaction between groups of users. Like their physical counterparts, both the political and the digital platform refers to a space that at once facilitates and conditions use. Since it is an apparatus of social order whose function is based on the stability of recurring patterns of behaviour, the platform embodies the quintessential meaning of institutional power. Leveling the ground. The term platform comes from the Middle French plateforme, or plateforme, which means flat form. The word refers to a specific physical artifact, a raised level surface. Arguably, the act of raising and leveling the ground is connected with human domestication and the gradual rise of sedentary domestic space. The anthropologist Tim Ingold wrote that hunter-gatherers perceive the land not as a surface, but as a constellation of permanent landmarks, such as mountains and lakes. With the gradual passage of semi-sedentary and sedentary life, permanence became more an issue of domesticating land as a surface. If the rise of domestic space predates the rise of agriculture, then leveling the ground for the sake of inhabitation can be seen as the earliest form of permanent living. The earliest known semi-permanent homes, such as those discovered at Ohalo, 21,000 BCE, on the southern bank of the Sea of Galilee, contain early evidence of the platform. The consolidation of the home as an enclosed permanent space was paralleled by the levelling of the dwelling's interior, on top of which sat an inch-thick cushion of alkali grass. This gesture of demarcation by elevation is evident in other ancient domestic spaces, such as houses found in Byblos, 8000 BCE, north of Beirut, in which floors were carefully flattened to ease their cleaning. Moreover, this kind of levelling was frequently the result of the fact that homes were often used as burial places too. Burial was instrumental to dwellers in legitimising permanent occupation. Yet a level floor was not just functional, but also symbolic. With its smooth and slightly elevated surface, it reinforced the contrast between the interior and the uneven topography of the outside landscape. The floor thus turned the house into a stage on which to perform what was the essential purpose of early permanent dwellings, the ritualization of life. Rituals are activities performed according to a predefined set of actions. The performance of a ritual always involves the definition of a place whose form is clearly organized in order to ensure its continuity. the floor of many early houses was comprised of a platform built purposely to differentiate areas dedicated to different activities, such as cooking, fasting, and sleeping, conferring theatrical emphasis to essential reproductive functions. This is clearly visible in one of the most extraordinary examples of Neolithic domestic architecture. The settlement found at Kartalhöyük, southern Anatolia, which was inhabited between 6500 and 5500 BCE. At Kartalhöyük, houses were accessed from the roof, which acted as a main stage for much of the inhabitants' daily lives, especially during the spring and summer. Activities inside the house were organized not by enclosed rooms, but by platforms of varying height, some used for cooking, while others were used for sleeping. Some of the platforms were built on pits in which deceased household members were buried. These were often adorned and clearly distinguished from other parts of the home. Kartalhöyük shows how, in early forms of sedentary inhabitation, the horizontal datum of the ground and not the vertical enclosure of walls defined the structure's use. Mounds, steps, and floors. With the rise of early cities, the use of platforms expanded from houses to large-scale structures. In Sumer Uruk, imposing platforms were used to set apart monumental complexes, such as the White Temple, from the rest of the city. Entire cities built by the Indus Valley civilization, such as Mohenjo-Daro, were constructed on top of gigantic platforms made of mud brick. These served two main purposes. They raised settlements against the floods and provided solid foundations. Moreover, as the entire population was involved in their construction, the building of platforms was the embodiment of both a communal effort to settle a specific place and make it inhabitable, and that community's control of the ground. A similar process was at stake in other civilizations, such as the Hohokam culture, which flourished from 300 to 1500 CE in the North American Southwest. Recent interpretations of the use of these platforms are often contrasting. For some archaeologists, such as Douglas B. Craig, they signified social interaction by collective labour and were used for communal ritual and fasting. On the other hand, for anthropologist Mark D. Elson, they were venues of social differentiation, where inequalities between members of society were created. These contrasting interpretations address the ambivalent role of platforms as means for both communal gatherings and social asymmetry. Yet it is precisely the explicitness with which ancient platforms played out social and symbolic roles that made them quintessential public archetypes. As was the case with domestic floors, platforms were stages that gave public emphasis to the actions that took place upon them. It is for this reason that in many ancient examples, such as Mayan pyramids and Greek sanctuaries, steps became the main architectural feature. The role of steps in these structures was to theatrically emphasize the movement of people by orienting them and providing a sense of rhythm. Historian Mary B. Holyshed argued that the foot's repeated contact with a sequence of horizontal surfaces at regular, predictable intervals translates to a sense of organization and system. Close intervals and compression of steps impress intensity of effort, or conversely, broader spacing brings a slower rhythm. Public platforms could also address static situations, such as the gathering of a community around a focal point. This is clearly evident in one of the most important examples of platforms in the Western ancient world, the threshing floor, a circular space made of compacted ground or paved stone, fenced off with rocks or delimited by a ditch. Threshing floors were used to separate grain from straw by having bulls or horses circle around, stomping on the harvested wheat. as argued by archaeologist Nikos Chalcidis, the perfect circularity and flatness of the floor, along with the rhythmic circling of the animals, allowed farmers to view the threshing floor as paradigm of the circularity of nature, in harmony with the seasons and movement of celestial bodies. In ancient Greece, this perception of the threshing floor was all the more evident, given the steep topography where flat ground was at a premium. Because their geometric form and prominent siting, threshing floors thus also operated as gathering places. Their congregational function was often an anticipation of important civic structures such as the bulletarian or assembly house and the theatre. Art historian Bonner Westcote notes that threshing floors were places of encounter and transformation, not only in the Greek world but throughout the ancient Mediterranean. They figure in the Old Testament and in the accounts of these Eleusinian mysteries as prime spaces of ritual action. These associations between gathering, ritual, and performance are visible in the so-called theatrical circle of the Sanctuary of the Gods in Samothrace, 600 BCE. Here, the circular level floor, framed by benches, merges the form of the threshing floor with that of the choros, which originally designated the dancing floor. Indeed, the Greek word for threshing floor, halos, is etymologically close to the word choros. Sacral circularity and axiality can be recognized as a paradigm for many more remarkable ancient types, such as the orchestra of Greek theatres, the ring of Roman amphitheatres, hippodromes, stadiums, and the podium of concert halls. Yet the ancient threshing floor shows a typology of ritualistic architecture that was still linked to everyday use. It therefore represents a condition whereby theatrical action was deeply embedded in daily existence and did not require too ceremonial or monumental an architecture. The symbolic and the utilitarian uses of space reinforced each other. Stages, plinths, and playgrounds. The platform as a theatrical space is perfectly embodied in the orchestra of the ancient Greek theatre. The orchestra was a flat ground between the scene and the audience. It was also a sacred area, since within Greek civilization, theatre was a form of worship. It is important to note that, in the performance of a tragedy, the orchestra mainly served as the space for the chorus, the group of performers who collectively commented on the dramatic action by reciting, singing, and dancing. The orchestra, at least in the early development of the Greek theatre, was thus not a stage for individual performers, but literally a dance floor for intensive performances that often involved audience participation. Precisely for this reason, the orchestra had to be perfectly flat and wide, and preferably circular. The orchestra is an example of a platform that blurs both the distinction between audience performers and spectators, as well as theatre and religious ritual. Here, the simple and abstract architecture of the platform functions as a powerful device that orients, solicits, and organises a collective body, giving it a specific form. It is therefore not by chance that theatre, a manipulation of the ground with its composition of wide flat surfaces and steps, became extremely influential in the development of modern monumentality. Think of modern Renaissance and Baroque villa, which in many cases is nothing more than a composition of sloping surfaces and terraces acting as stages. Examples include Donato Bramante's Belvedere Courtyard, whose construction started in 1503, and Piero Ligorio's Villa d'Este, started in 1560. Here, the sloping landscape is reinterpreted through a sequence of plateaus connected by monumental ramps and flights of stairs. In both cases, the villa is conceived as a gigantic multi-level stage on which every gesture would acquire a performative solemnity. The massive earthworks that were necessary to build a monumental villa garden on a slope were often used by landowners as a way to dispossess local residents of their use of common land. In order to hide the violence of this dispossession, landowners partially opened their villas as public open-air museums, in which admission was granted based on a strict code of behaviour. The garden as a sequence of platforms and plateaus formalised this code through carefully choreographed sequences of movements and stoppages. Soon, such theatrical landscapes made of platforms and ramps were expanded from the villa to the city. During the Renaissance, and even more in the Baroque European city, slopes often provided the opportunity for ground alterations that would turn circulation into a processional spectacle. The most notable example of this approach is Alessandro Specci's design for the so-called Spanish Steps in Rome of 1725. A monumental staircase that connects Piazza di Spagna with the Church of Trinità dei Monti. Here the steps are both a means to ascend to the church and a system of benches cascading towards the piazza in the manner of a theatre. Yet precisely at the time that the city was being designed as a theatrical space, theatre itself was becoming increasingly confined to a specialised architecture whose function was to establish a clear-cut distinction between stage and audience. Simultaneous to these processes was the increasing control and suppression of theatrical performances on the streets, which had been an important tradition of medieval Europe. What was at stake in the shift of theatre from outdoor to indoor spectacle was the possibility for elites to establish rules for performing in public, thus limiting the political influence of theatre to the social life of a city. A fundamental break with the strict separation between stage and audience was promoted by the Swiss scenographer Adolphe Appia, whose work is considered among the most influential contributions to 20th century theatre. In 1909, Appia conceived an innovative type of stage that he defined as espaces rhythmiques. These were meant for the performance of eurythmics, a discipline invented by Émile Jacques Dalcroze to teach rhythm and musical expression using bodily movements. Appia conceived these rhythmic spaces not so much as scenography, but as a platform composed of steps, ramps, and a low wall, an architecture reduced to its simplest volumetric expression. He intended this abstract design to extend from the stage, far beyond the traditional scope of scenography, and to make bodily movement the absolute protagonist of the stage. Appia and Jacques Dalcroze collaborated in 1913 on the staging of Orpheus and Eurydice by Christoph Willibald Gluck for the Hallerau Theatre, where the set was reduced to a gigantic staircase that could be arranged in different ways. Indeed, Appia conceived theatre as a space of interaction in which architecture would provide only a horizontal articulation. Appia imagined a whole world no longer enclosed by walls or scenes, but rather made up of platforms, where no prescribed way to interact or perform was put forward. In Appia's idea of the stage, the platform became an abstract form, an ostensible artificial ground devoid of any symbolism and institutional control, and ready to enable unforeseen ways to live and move together. Architectural historians have noted the influence of Appia's Espaces Rhythmiques on two remarkable examples of platforms in modern architecture. Ludwig Mies van der Rohe's plinths, a recurring motif in most of his projects, and Le Corbusier's idea of the roof garden, such as the terrace in the Unité de Habitation in Marseille. In the Barcelona Pavilion, the Seagram Building in New York, and the Toronto Dominion Centre, the plinth both supports the built structures and provides open space free from any specialised programme. Mises' subtle use of steps in the Seagram building's plinth is certainly reminiscent of an important example of platform in ancient architecture, the crepidoma, the stepped platform on which temples were erected. Yet unlike in temples, the steps of the Seagram building monumentalize the empty space in front of the tower rather than the tower itself. In Le Corbusier's roof garden at the Marseille Unité, architecture is reduced to an abstract composition of platforms and volumes, which the architect envisaged as a playground for both children and adults, in his own words, an esplanade for physical culture. The roof garden includes an open-air theatre built in concrete, where, like in Appiah's stage design, performances could be held, quote, without any mise-en-scène or expenses, end quote. Architectural historian Ross Anderson has remarked how Le Corbusier's roof garden reveals a great affinity with Appiah's Espaces rhythmiques, not just in terms of form, but also in purpose. In both cases, the architecture of steps, platforms, and bare volumes incites intense use and physical movement rather than contemplation. Yet even more significant are Aldo van Eyck's hundreds of playgrounds built in many of Amsterdam's in-between spaces between 1947 and 78. These playgrounds can be interpreted as an urban realization of Appiah's radical reinvention of the stage as a platform open to unforeseen uses. These humble examples of architecture, made mostly of repetitive elements such as concrete blocks, different surface materials, and metal circles, squares, and triangles, were conceived as platforms where the everyday, understood as repetitive, dimensions of life could take place. One of the striking characteristics of Van Eyck's playgrounds is that they were not fenced, differently from most playgrounds at the time. Instead, they were occasionally marked either by raised surfaces, different surface material, or simply through the careful positioning of small walls and benches. This suggests an active participation of both children that had to develop the skill of anticipating danger and manage it, and parents who had to watch their children cooperatively. Participation and active imagination were also stimulated by the abstract character of the playground structures. These did not have a prescribed function and instead provided simple support to constant invention and reinvention. And Amsterdam's playground, similar to the platforms proposed by Appiah, Le Corbusier and Mies, implicitly questioned the relationships between inside and outside, figure and ground, top and bottom, which have settled over the millennia to reinforce the private possession of land. It is only the utopian reinterpretation of the platform put forward by Appiah and Van Eyck as defined and yet unbound space that opens up radically alternative ways of using the ground beyond possession and control. Opening up the design of the ground to new forms of imagination is particularly urgent today, when access and use of urban space are often strictly determined by codes of behaviour and rights of property. Moreover, the right to access of differently abled users demands a radical rethinking of the architecture of the ground towards inclusive solutions. It is precisely the right to freely access and use the ground, as exemplified by Van Eyck's playgrounds, that should inspire alternative ways of conceiving the open spaces of our cities. Of course, spatial justice is something that goes far beyond what architectural form can do on its own, but architecture can and should be mobilized to offer at least glimpses of unforeseen possibilities. So that's the end of the introductory essay in the book Platforms. It then has 30 examples of platforms. I'm just going to read the paragraph that it has under the example of the Sydney Opera House. The project that perhaps best demonstrates Jørn Utzon's fascination with the platform is his famous Sydney Opera House, Although this masterpiece became very well known for the shell-like parabolas of its roof structure, these iconic forms were in fact motivated by an attempt to better express the horizontality of the base on which they stand, which functions as a generous public gathering space, a town square, and an outdoor auditorium. Rather than a series of sweeping roof forms, the project should therefore instead be understood as a platform, a monumental podium 180 metres long, 120 metres wide and 12 metres high, on top of which the spectator observes a completed work of art and beneath which every preparation for the performance takes place. The images of the project that illustrate Utzon's seminal essay Platforms and Plateaus, published in Zodiac magazine in 1962, while the building was nearing the final phase of its construction, clearly reveal this line of thought. The text is accompanied by a series of black and white model images depicting large flights of steps of different dimensions and configurations, both linear and curved, that would allow external access to the platform and accommodate the seats of the concert hall itself. Imagining the proposed opera house in this way must certainly have been influenced by the site that was made available to the participants of the International Design Competition. The building was to occupy one of the most beautiful parts of the city, the peninsula of Bennelong Point in Sydney Harbour, adjacent to the central business district, and from which the articulated landscape of Port Jackson could be admired. Considering this condition, Utzon's fascination with Mayan architecture is immediately brought to mind. To escape the dense jungle where they lived, the Maya constructed platforms at the same height as the jungle canopy, from which they were able to obtain a new dimension, and completely change their perception of the landscape to correspond, quote, with the greatness of their gods. The power of this archetypal form must have remained in Utzon's mind during the development of his competition entry. So I have a few things to comment on ground or platforms, I guess, especially in the context of Melbourne. I guess the first thing to note is that from the essay is the exclusion of Schinkel, who also used platforms. And I would say that this is where Meese got his, start in the use of platforms, even in his first neoclassical houses. The second is something that I've not seen discussed is the great kind of injustice that is the sloped square of Federation Square, essentially the ground between the buildings that form the public, privately owned square. It is not accessible to the elderly, it would not be possible to use a wheelchair on that space. But most of all, I believe that its incline, would make it uncomfortable space to congregate, essentially, to form protests, let's say. So I think the inaccessibility of that square, of Federation Square, is kind of a mark of the general approach to public squares in Melbourne, of which there are now none. The other thing is the use of bluestone, as I guess in one of the previous, in the Adam Caruso reading, I was talking about smoothness in architecture. One example, especially through late capitalism, one example of this in particular is the use of bluestone in Melbourne. Obviously, the pavements are bluestone and these are publicly owned spaces. But you'll notice in shopping centres such as QV, I think designed by NH, the bluestone continues from the public realm into seamlessly or, without friction into the space of the shopping centre, and that is a perfect example of smoothness and maybe also like an appropriation of public infrastructure. Another example of that is, I think, on Exhibition Street with the Westpac Bank headquarters, where the smooth honed kind of bluestone continues from the street through to their forecourt and into the lobby itself. So I think it's great that PV's turned to this, the idea of ground. It seems like it has a lot of potential.